Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 80 countries around the world over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on harvesting rainwater when we come back. You know, during World War II, our parents and our grandparents planted victory gardens, and that helped to provide their own food and food and fiber for themselves and their country. Now, today, more than half of the food that you and I eat is imported from outside of our borders, and our food is produced from hybrid seed that will not reproduce, and it's nutritionally deficient. Now, a fellow by the name of Adolf Steinbrom of Fairbanks, Iowa, put the matter into perspective one time by having samples of corn tested for the nutrients that they contained and that are usually added to the commercial feeds. And when he compared this to more than 4,000 samples of hybrid corn tested in 10 Midwest states in a recent year, Steinbrom's open pollinated corn contained 75% more crude protein, 875% more copper, 345% more iron, 205% more manganese, and on it went. And the same result was seen in the content of the calcium and sodium and magnesium and zinc. And in the opinion of many ecologic farmers, these hybrid seeds merely mask poor farming practices by producing bins and bushels of foodless food without the nutrients that are really food's reason for being in the first place. Now, if you'd like to know more about this multinational corporate monopoly of our seed and food supplies and how you can make yourself independent from them, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package first? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number to call is 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Just click on the email and then send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Harvesting rainwater. Now, that sounds kind of bizarre, doesn't it? I have a book here in front of me. It's called Harvesting Rainwater for Drylands. That's written by a fellow named Brad Lancaster. It's part and parcel of a number of books that I have on the subject of small farms and small farming. How do you make $100,000 a year on 25 acres or less? I told you that story here recently. A fellow by the name of Booker T. Watley came up with a plan to do that some years back on a Rockefeller grant, and was pretty successful at it. It had some deficiencies, I thought, in it. Didn't follow the agricultural laws of the Bible. That was one. Didn't have a marketing plan. That was two. But I think that the overall idea that Watley came up with, I thought, was sheer genius. In fact, it was so good, I looked back in history and I found out, you know, when we Americans were the most successful in our agriculture, it's when we've had small farms. You know, when families were living on small farms, 25, 50 acres, 80 acres, something like that. Today, of course, our farms are thousands of acres. I had a student in here one time. He's Mississippi. He farms 3,000 acres of soybeans every year. 3,000 acres. You know how much ground that is, 3,000 acres? When you take 3,000, you divide that by 640. And that's 4.68 square miles. 640 acres, that's one square mile. That's a field, that's a mile on each side. That's a fur piece. That's a big piece of real estate. And you go out there and start farming that with a John Deere D and see what happens. Now these are corporate farms. These are big operations. And they produce, you know, tens of thousands of bushels of grain, railroad cars full. And they have irrigation systems now here in the Midwest. You know, they'll irrigate maybe, 160 acres at a time. They're called circle pivots. It's like having a sprinkler out in your front yard, you know, watering the grass. Only these things are a quarter of a mile long. I mean, they're a quarter of a mile long. And they go around in a big circle over here, see, and they irrigate the land. Of course, that sucks up the water out of the ground. The groundwater dries up, and then we don't know what happens when the groundwater goes dry. We haven't been down that road yet, but we're getting close to it. And I've reported that on the program here a time or two. Now, there's a process that's been going on for hundreds of years, maybe thousands. I probably would tell you thousands. Down in the southwestern United States, you know, down in places, you know, like Arizona and Southern California and New Mexico and West Texas and so on, there were Indian tribes living down there in those desert regions down northern Mexico and so on. Pretty dry piece of real estate, like Tucson, Arizona, Phoenix, Arizona, where it rains less than a foot a year. I mean, they get less than 12 inches of rain a year. Now, if you're from the eastern United States, east side of the Mississippi River, you people are used to getting 50 inches of rain a year. And if you live on the west side of the Mississippi River, well, after you get past Missouri, get out into Kansas and Colorado, you know, you're looking at maybe 20 inches of rain a year. Quite a little difference. And then there's the desert southwest, and they get about 12 inches a year, about 1 foot of rain per year. And so we call that the desert, and they call those desert areas, and they call that perpetual drought. And we use this word drought pretty liberally here. And out in the western United States, we have a drought going on now. It's been going on for about 10 years. And there's been a succession of droughts going on out here in the western United States. And now we have this drought in the east. See, we always thought drought belonged in Arizona because, you know, they only get 12 inches of rain a year anyway. We didn't think drought belonged in Georgia and Tennessee, where they get 50 inches a year. But now we have a drought. And in the last 10 or 15 years, we've heard the word drought used in Florida several times. I mean, that's like having a drought in the Amazon rainforest. What do you mean, drought in the Amazon rainforest? How can that be? Well, a drought doesn't mean that it doesn't rain at all. It means that there's less rain. You know, for instance, I live here in an area that we get around 40 to 50 inches a year. You know, normal rainfall, 45, 48, 49 inches. Sometimes it'll rain 52, 54, 55 inches. Well, a couple of years ago, we only got about 35 inches. Now, the difference between 35 inches or 38 inches and 48 inches and 52 inches is quite a bit. When you're used to getting 45 and you get 35, that 10-inch difference over there is pushing 25%. And we called that a drought here. We were suffering from drought conditions. Last summer, I started feeding hay in August. I had to feed hay for about 3 or 4 weeks in August, and then it rained again in September, and we got a little bit of grass. And over the last 4 or 5 years, I've noticed here that we're not getting the rain in due season. I reported that to you a time or two. In the Bible, it talks about rain in due season. Now, you can be getting 50 inches a year, and you people in Tucson, Arizona can laugh and say, well, that fool, he's got 50 inches a year. He doesn't know what drought is. Oh, yeah, I do. Yeah, we know what drought is. Drought is when you're not getting rain in due season. Now, we might be getting 40 inches a year here, but if it doesn't come at the right time, the grass doesn't grow. For instance, you know, grass doesn't grow here in January, February, and if it rains a lot in January and February, it's not really important, but it charges the ground with water, and so the soil will be saturated with water, and there'll be plenty of moisture there to grow grass in March, April, May, and June. Then, if it doesn't rain in July and August, 2 months, just 8 weeks, the grass dries up. The soil is depleted of moisture. The grass dries up and the cows don't have any grass to eat in September, October, and November. And then you got to feed hay. Now, in a normal year, it rains in July and August. So we have grass in July and August and September, October, November. It's common here to feed cattle right up to Christmas or close to it. And then we feed hay starting around the 15th of December, let's say, until maybe the 15th of March or maybe the 1st of April. So let's see, we got January, February, and March. That's 3 months. And then maybe a half a month in December, so we're feeding hay for 3.5 months. Now, when it doesn't rain in July and August, and we have to start feeding hay in September, all of a sudden you got September, October, November, December, that's 4 months. Then January, February, and March, that's 7 months. All of a sudden we're feeding hay twice as long. It takes twice as much hay. And so then your profit goes way down. And then we cry a lot. Ain't nothing like having a farmer crying, you know, tears dripping off his chin, making you feel real bad over here because he didn't get enough rain, you know. Now, people in the city, they don't consider that at all. When you're watching the weather forecast on the boob tube, they're talking about, oh, the weekend's going to be good. It's going to be clear and no rain. See, good weather for city people is when it doesn't rain. They don't care anything about rain. They don't care anything about drought. When they want water, they just turn on the faucet, and it's always there. They don't know where it comes from, don't really care. They don't watch how much rain we're getting per year. They don't care when the rain comes. It doesn't make any difference to a city dweller if it rains in January or July. Boy, those farmers up in Iowa, when it rains in July, they smile. They jump up and down, do rain dances. They get real excited, you know, when it rains in January or snows, they don't get excited at all. And that's because they're not going out water skiing on the weekend anyway. Hell, if a farmer had a weekend, he'd be out there working in his fields. He'd be out there working, building fence or something. So people have a different perception here as to what famine or what drought is all about. Farmers are concerned about it, but they're a very small minority of people here in the United States, representing less than 2 million people. Out of 300 million. We don't even represent 1%. You get down to the bottom line. So we're just kind of inconsequential over here. And now we don't even provide half the food that you people in the city are eating. You know, you're importing your food from Chile and Argentina. You're getting your cheese, you know, from Holland and France and importing wine. You know, Americans are living the good life. Well, they have been up until now. I don't know how good this thing's going to continue to be, but we've been living the good life here. And we Americans, we produce a lot of wheat and a lot of corn and soybeans, and we ship that around the world. But you know, when it gets down to where you're buying garlic, that's coming from China now. When you're buying grapes, well, they're probably coming from California, you know, some of the time, but then the rest of the time they're coming from Chile or someplace else. And when you go into the supermarket and you're buying that food, you know, out of the supermarket, you people, you haven't been thinking about it in the past, but you're going to very shortly, coming to a city near you. There's going to be some shortages. You're going to see rationing. During World War II, we had food rationing here in the United States. Most of you people can't remember that. Maybe never even heard of it. Rationing in America? You mean people stood in lines? Yeah, we did. And there were some things you couldn't get, you know, like cinnamon and things and coffee, things that came from faraway places, tea, things that are imported into the United States. You know, we had to stand in line, get red buttons and coupons. You had to get ration cards and things like that. It's coming again. It's coming again. Now, it's coming partly because of foreign policy, but it's coming also partly because of drought. And a fellow by the name of Brad Lancaster wrote a book on harvesting rainwater for dry lands. In fact, he wrote two of them. I'm going to give you a report here on volume one. Because surprisingly enough, when I looked into the subject, I was really amazed. You know, you people down there in Arizona have all the rainwater falling on that piece of real estate called Arizona that you need? It's a fact. In fact, let me tell you something. Do you know how much rain falls on Arizona every year? And how many people live there in Arizona? Well, here's the number. Nearly 13 cubic miles of rainwater. This is 13 cubic miles of water fall on Arizona every year. Now, Arizona is a pretty big piece of real estate. It's about 114,000 square miles. And there's this Arizona Central Project or Central Arizona Project, and then you got the Central California Project, and then you got the Colorado River Project, and we've built these huge dams all over the country, but especially there in the West, you know, to collect all this snowmelt and then to put it in these huge reservoirs. I mean, we have gigantic projects over there. It just bedazzles people and boggles your mind how we can deliver water, you know, from the Rocky Mountains of Colorado to Phoenix, Arizona. It's quite a little story. And that Colorado River actually runs through Arizona. It's kind of in a big deep ditch, you know, as it goes through Arizona. They call it the Grand Canyon. But anyway, the water that is a big deal out there in the West, and people are fighting over that water all the time. Farmers are fighting over it, and city people are fighting over it. And now the Colorado River has been running at about one-third. That's kind of a shocker. Normally it runs about 15 million acre-feet a year, about 15 million acre-feet a year. Now, an acre-foot of water is an acre of land. Now, an acre of land is 210 feet by 210 feet. So just to give you an idea, it's about the size of a city block in a city. Now, take that city block and build a little dike all the way around it, you know, and then kind of like the curb, you know, it's not quite a foot, but it's to give you an idea, and then fill that thing up with 12 inches of water, and that's 1 acre-foot. That's about 326,000 gallons of water. And then to give you a little idea, how much water do you use at your house every year? And then the answer is about 80,000 gallons a year. 80,000. So if you had an acre foot of water, you got enough water there to take care of the needs for about 16 houses, about 16 families, just about everybody that lives on that block. You know, if you had four houses on each side of that block, 210 feet, and you took 12 inches of water on that city block, you'd have enough water to take care of those people in those residences for 1 year. Now, when I was a kid, people used to use water at the rate of about 3,500 gallons a month. And I was looking at some numbers the other day. It's over 7,000 now, 7,000 gallons a month. That's a lot of water. Of course, you know, when I was a kid, we used to take a bath about once a week. And so you used to have a thing called a bathtub. It was a big pot, and you get in this big pot and you wash. Today, everybody takes a shower for about a half an hour. That's what I do. I get in the shower for about a half an hour, and it runs about 3 gallons a minute. How much water does it take me to see? If I take a 30-minute shower at 3 gallons a minute, 3 times 30, that's 90. It takes me 90 gallons of water to take a shower, and there's four of us here in the family, 9, 18, 27, 36. It takes us 300, and we do that every day. I take a shower every morning before I come down here to the studio. I get out of bed, and I'm just kind of fogged out, you know, so I run in the shower, and I wake up in the shower, burn up 90 gallons of water. Can you believe it? Well, if I'd have told you this story in 1944, you guys would have laughed at me and said, that guy's a liar. It's impossible. Can't happen. Well, we Americans are used to using a lot of water. Now, most people in the world don't have running water. Believe it or not, they don't even have running water, let alone a shower. And then I've got hot water. Most people don't even have running water, let alone hot water. And here I am burning it up at the rate of 90 gallons. I get in the I don't always take 30-minute showers, but, you know, sometimes I do. We use a lot of water. Now, when you multiply that times 16 families in the neighborhood, and you take an acre foot of water, is 80,000 gallons for everybody in the neighborhood, that's a lot of water. Now, when we take a look at places, you know, like Arizona, we have been told all of our lives that we have to have these huge projects, you know, like the Grand Coulee Dam. You know, you got to have the California or the Central California Water Project to deliver water to all you people down there in Southern California. And that's the way that game is played. You know, you got to have these huge water projects over here, worth billions and billions of taxpayer dollars, and that's good politics, and I'm sure of that. What I want to show you here this week is that's not true. That's a lie. You not only don't need it, it doesn't deliver to you as much water as you've already got in your backyard. That's right. You people down in Arizona, about 5 million of you. Do you know how much water falls on your state every year? Okay, take that Colorado River. And the Colorado River is running about, you know, in a good year. I mean, if it was running at normal flow, it would be 15 million acre feet a year. Right now, it's running around 5, 6, 7 million acre feet, about half to a third, about one third to one half of what it normally runs. Okay. And down in Arizona, the amount of rainfall that falls on your state every year is three times that. Yeah, that's right, three times. Now, Arizona has to share that water with California and Colorado and Utah. So you're sharing that water with these other states. And so you're fighting over this 15 million acre feet of water when there is that much in there. And the truth of the matter is, you already have three times that amount of water falling on your state every year anyway. You people in Arizona don't need a drop of water out of the Colorado River. Do you know that? Not a drop. And you get three times more water falling on your state. Now, your real problem there in Arizona is that you're not collecting what's falling on your state. Now, here's a shocker. Get your pencils out here, children. I'll tell you a story. Do you know how much water runs off of your house and runs out into the street and down the sewer or down the water drain? 75%. So if you take all that water that's flowing through Arizona every year, 75% of it runs off into the ocean. You're only using 25% of your water. Now, if you could boost that up, you know, to where you're using about half of it, you people in Arizona have all the water that you can use, and probably a little bit more on top of that. Now, that's in Arizona where it's pretty dry. Now, you people in Georgia, where you get about 50 inches a year, let's take a look here at Georgia and see how many gallons of water you get. Here's Georgia right here, area in square miles, pushing 60,000 square miles. And you people in Georgia, you get 45 cubic miles of water falling on your piece of real estate. Now, listen to this. Arizona is 114,000 square miles. Georgia is about half as big, and gets four times as much rain. And they got a drought down there in Georgia right now. It's like they're complaining about their drought. Now, you people there in Phoenix, Arizona, where you get 7 inches of rain a year, and you look at Georgia getting 50 inches of rain a year, and you say, well, those people over there, they don't know what drought is. Now, let's cut Georgia in half. Just give them 25 inches. That's three times more rain than you're getting there in Phoenix. Three times more rain. And the people in Georgia, their lakes are drying up, and they're, you know, things are just going to pot. And same thing in Tennessee and Florida and Alabama. Alabama is the wettest state in the union. Believe it or not, Alabama, they get, it's about 50,000 square miles. They get 46 cubic miles. It's smaller than Georgia, and they get more rain. Isn't that amazing? And they got a drought there. And they're just complaining, you know, just right and left. Oh, my God, we just don't know what we're going to do. In fact, they got water rationing now going on in Atlanta, Georgia. I saw that the other day. There's some towns. They're talking about evacuating whole towns in Georgia and Alabama. They're going to just take all the people in those towns and evacuate them. I don't know where they're going to evacuate them to. It's like a nuclear war. I mean, you know, you got a bomb drops, and you can understand why, you know, there's danger here, so we might have to evacuate you people, you know, 100, 200, 500 miles, get you out here somewhere and take care of you. That's what they're talking about here in the southeastern United States. Now, over in Tucson, Arizona, where they only get 12 inches of rain to start with, they're not going to evacuate Tucson. But when the rainfall in Georgia drops below 25 inches a year, they're going to have to evacuate you people. No, wait a minute. Hang on a second. You know, you got millions of people living in Arizona in two big metropolitan areas, Tucson and Phoenix, and they don't even get 12 inches of rain a year, and they're not going to evacuate. They're going to stay right there and live their lives out in the desert. Now, it would seem like to me that you people in Florida, Alabama, and Georgia, and Tennessee, where you get 50 inches of rain, 40 inches of rain, 30 inches of rain a year, could live there. Now, you people down there in the Southwest are probably sitting there going, well, yeah, sure, they ought to be able to live there. Well, you see, there are certain regions of the country that get certain rainfalls, and that's normal. Here's a couple of illustrations. You know, it can rain a lot in one place, and it doesn't rain very much in another. Over in Hawaii, there's an island out there called Kauai. Kauai Island. Not very big. Hell, you can drive around the whole island in 3 hours. You can't quite drive around it because the road doesn't go all the way around. It only goes about three-quarters of the way or 80% of the way around it. But this island's not very big. I mean, in 3 hours, you know, you can start at one end of the road up at the north end of the island, drive all the way around three-quarters of the island, and in about 3 hours. I don't know how big the island is in square miles, but, you know, it's not all that big. Well, we got a mountain on this island. And on this mountain is the wettest place in the world, and it rains 700 inches a year. And when they told me that, it boggled my mind, you know, 700 inches a year. Do you know how much rain that is? Just plug 700 in here and divide that by 12. That's 58 inches a month. You know, if you're getting 60 inches of rainfall a year, we call that a temperate rainforest. These guys are getting 60 inches a month. Now, that's not on this whole island. This little island, they don't get 60 inches over the whole island. It's just on this mountain, maybe 25% of the island. Then as you're driving south, and you get south or north, I can't tell you which direction we're going here on this island, but I'm just going to use a number. You drive around the island to the south end of the island, and you run into a desert. Honest to God, I'm not pulling your leg here, folks. They got a desert on this island. You know, it's not as big as Arizona. You know, the whole state of Hawaii is only 6,000 square miles. But this one island over here, I doubt if it's 1,000 square miles. Hell, I doubt if it's much bigger than Ozark County, Missouri. Probably, maybe even smaller than our county here, you know. And on this island, they've got 700 inches of rain on the north end, and they've got maybe 12 inches of rain on the south end of it. And after you go through the desert, you get on this road, you keep on the road, and it goes up into the mountains, coming up the backside of this big mountain over here, say, where the drought is. And you get up to 3,000 feet, and there's a redwood forest there. I'm not pulling your leg. I'm telling you, there's a redwood forest on this island in Hawaii. Now, I'm from Northern California, so I can recognize a redwood tree, kids. I'm from Eureka, and I know what a redwood tree looks like. And what happened here was somebody back about 1880, as the story goes, they got these redwood trees out of California, and they took them over to Hawaii. And they planted them up here about 3,000 feet. Now, redwoods grow at about 30 to 40 inches of rain a year. And up here at 3,000 feet on the backside of the mountain is about 30 to 40 inches of rain. It's up high enough off the desert that they've got some rainfall up here. And it's not big, it's not huge, but I imagine they have 500 or 1,000 trees up there. Good-sized trees, you know, 3 foot on the stump. You know, they're good big trees. Now, take a look at that. Here's this little island. You got a desert like Tucson, Arizona. You got the wettest place in the world. I think that's what they advertised. If it's not, it's the second or third. It's, you know, it's got to be right up there 700 inches a year. And there's a couple other places that rain like that too. But, you know, this place, I think, edges them out and get kind of a record there. And then you got a redwood forest on this same little island over here, you know, maybe 800 square miles. I mean, about 800 square miles of real estate. Not a very big piece of real estate. Smaller than Rhode Island. All right, now Port Angeles, Washington is another place. They get about 30 inches of rain there a year on Puget Sound, you know, up west of Seattle, Washington, a little town there, about 30,000 people. They call it Port Angeles, Washington, 30 inches a year. Now, go on down the coast there about 30 miles, and you come to Mount Olympus, Olympic National Park. Hell, it rains 100 inches a year. 30 miles further down, rains 100 inches. So this rainfall thing, you know, changes, you know, and in some cases, it doesn't have to go very far. I mean, you don't have to travel from Denver, you know, to Memphis, you know, to get a big change in rainfall. It can just be over a short period or a short distance. And then there's some other factors that come into this rainfall thing over here that we'll talk about as we progress along. And then we'll talk about how do you harvest that rainwater? What does this harvesting rainwater have to do? If people can live in Tucson, Arizona on 12 inches a year, how do they do that? They must be doing something different than you people in Atlanta, Georgia. They gotta be. You people in Atlanta with 20 inches of rain are sitting there saying, oh my God, we're gonna die, we're in a drought. Hell, in Wichita, Kansas, that's all the rain they get in a year is 20 inches. People in Wichita, they're not evacuating their town. Now, you people there in Atlanta, Georgia, can live on 20 inches of rain a year. Honest to God, you could. You don't know how. You don't. And it isn't possible, and they're going to evacuate you out of your city. But if you knew how, you could. Before we finish here, I'm going to show you how to stay right there and live in Atlanta, Georgia, on less than 12 inches of rain a year. You don't need 50 inches. 75% of all the water in Georgia runs off your property and down into the river, which then goes into the ocean. 75% of all the water that's fallen on your land is being wasted. And the same thing's true for all you people down there in Tucson, Arizona, too. All that water falling on your ground, it's being wasted. 75% of it. Now, if we could save some of that water, you know, we could end that drought with global warming. Let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, it's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, then please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. That's for your listening convenience. And The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. And we do that 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School and asking for it. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. We often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and we don't support the viewpoints necessarily of all of these institutions wholeheartedly or 100%. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. So for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, remember our website is georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about harvesting rainwater. Now, normally when we talk about harvest, we're talking about we're going to harvest corn, harvest wheat, harvest soybeans. We're harvesting our garden. Has anybody ever thought about harvesting rainwater? Why would you want to do such a thing? Now, if you live in Tucson, Arizona, and you want to grow things, you want to have trees that normally grow in areas where rainfall is heavier, for instance, could we grow redwood trees in Fresno, California? And the answer is absolutely. But you're in Fresno, California, it only rains 7 inches a year. It rains about as much in Fresno, California, as it does in Phoenix, Arizona. Well, could you grow redwood trees in Phoenix, Arizona? Certainly. Certainly. But you're going to have to water them. You're going to have to water them. And the natural rainfall that is falling on the area is not enough to sustain a redwood forest in Phoenix, Arizona, or Fresno, California. But, you know, as you're driving around, you'll see that people in their yards will have some pretty exotic plants. Here, for instance, we have a greenhouse, and my wife has a rubber tree. Now, rubber trees don't grow well here in Missouri, as a general rule. Banana trees, orange trees. But, you know, if you create the environment for it, you can grow them. For instance, in Hawaii, I mentioned they got a redwood forest up here on the 3,000-foot level on Kauai, the island. It happens that you've got the right climate that would match Humboldt County, California, to grow redwood trees at that location. So if you brought redwood trees over there and planted them, you know, they'll grow naturally there. In Fresno, California, there's some redwood trees growing around the city. And those people have to irrigate. They have to water those trees. That's all. Now, if at any time the people of Fresno abandon that site and leave there, well, then over time, those trees will die. And that'll be the end of that. And they'll go back to where the natural ecology grows, or where the natural plants of the area grow. That's the way it is out in Arizona. You got these cactus growing out here in the desert, and you don't have lush, rolling farmland, you know, full of pasture and cattle, you know, up to their belly like they have in Kentucky, where they have plenty of rain and where things grow well. They got plenty of grass in Kentucky. They don't have any drought there. You don't have that when we're talking about Arizona, New Mexico. But could we? Could we? And the answer is absolutely, absolutely. And that's what the story here is all about. When we're talking about rainwater over here, we're talking about harvesting rainwater, that is using the natural amount of water that's available. And then instead of letting 75% of it wash off the land or flow away from the land, we're going to collect it. We're going to save it. We're going to do something with it. That's a wild new idea. You know, stop thinking about it. And so the guy is telling a little story over here, and I'm going to read you a short story here first. Here's a real life example down in Tucson, Arizona, of a guy who actually harvests the rainwater on his lot. We're not talking about some big farm or some big ranch out here. He's talking about a guy that's got a piece of real estate over here. And the guy's name is Matthew Nelson and Mary Sarvak, and they come very close to living within their rainwater budget. You can see much of their annual rainwater supply in the middle of their living room. It's a 2,500-gallon. It's a ferro cement cistern, and it rises 3 feet from a hole in the floor. It's a desert water hole carved into bedrock. It looks like a Tanaja. Now, a Tanaja is a desert water hole which is carved into the bedrock and collects water. The Indians used to do that. The people in the Middle East did that. People that were in city-states, you know, like Jerusalem, would carve rock cisterns and collect the rainwater in Jerusalem. And then when Nebuchadnezzar or some foreign army would circle their city and cut them off, it didn't affect them. Whatever rain fell, they would collect it, and they had enough water for the people inside the city. Now, that sounds a little bit wild. Have any of you people in Atlanta, Georgia, thought of that, collecting the rainwater in a cistern and saving it? Well, no, because you never had to in the past. It's never been necessary. You know, if you're living in the Amazon Basin and it's raining 120 inches a year, you need a cistern like you need three thumbs on your left hand. But if you're living in Tucson, Arizona, you need a cistern. You need a water collection device. Now, these water collection devices have been used all over the world in dry regions, the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan. I mean, come on. Australia. People live in dry lands. And when they live in dry lands, they have to have a different modality than we who live in places that rains 50 inches a year. Now, I live in a place that doesn't quite rain 50 inches, but we get 40 inches plus every year. And so we're used to that, and we depend upon that. Hell, out in California, they don't get that much. I said I was at the beginning of the program, I'm complaining when I have to feed my cattle, you know, 6 months of the year. Hell, they feed their cattle out there 6 months a year. Or they need more rangeland for more cows. Now, I'll give you an illustration here. It takes 3 acres to run one cow-calf. You got a cow, she has a calf, we're going to raise the calf up to 6 months and sell it. We got to have 3 acres of ground. I talked to ranchers out in Nevada and Idaho and Montana, and maybe they got to have 50 acres for that same cow and calf. Maybe they got to have 100. I heard of some places out in New Mexico where they have a section, 640 acres to run a cow and a calf. I said, you know, if I had 640 acres here in Missouri, I'd sell it and retire. I was talking to a guy out there in Nevada. He's got a ranch out there that's bigger. This is the Pine Creek Ranch. It's bigger than the state of Rhode Island. Yeah, boys and girls, I mean, they got ranches out here in the West bigger than some of these states in the East. Now, of course, they don't grow a whole lot, and they don't get a lot of rain. You know, down in Las Vegas, Nevada, they got a big city down here, more than a million people, 7 inches of rain a year. They're not planning to evacuate Las Vegas. Now, of course, they've got to bring in water. And in the past, we have always used big, huge government-financed projects, you know, like Hoover Dam. And then they impound water in these huge lakes, and then that creates a lot of recreation and a lot of boat docks and ramps and restaurants. And we're used to that. Now, there's a little better way to do that, and I'll share that with you as we progress along, because there's other people in the world that are living their lives, and they're not getting ready to evacuate whole cities, you know, because it doesn't rain 40 inches a year. Now, you see, when you're getting 50 inches a year and you reduce that to 40, that's drought conditions. When you're getting 40, you reduce that to 30, that's drought conditions. See, a drought in Tucson, Arizona is where they get 12 inches a year, and it's reduced to 9 inches a year, they got a drought. It's just a matter of perception, kids. There's places in the world where it doesn't even rain 9 inches a year. And those people can live there. How do they do that? What is it that they're doing that we're not? Well, here's a couple living down here in Arizona. Peering into the topless cistern, you come face to face with the rainwater that has drained in from the downspout in the middle of their 1,500-square-foot roof. That rainwater supply meets all of their domestic water needs, except drinking water. As they use their water, they see its level drop. You get more conservative, and as you see the water level fall, says Matt. Though when the water level is high in the middle of the rainy season, they feel free to indulge a little. Talking about their harvested rainwater, Mary says, during the intense heat of July and August, we can walk in the door of our home and splash cool water all over ourselves, or we can just jump in. The system was designed to supply the average water needs of a family of three for 4 months, between rains, typical for this site. Their rainfall averages 14 inches a year. A 10-gallon RV pump pressurizes the water and sends it throughout the house to all of the sinks, the bathroom, and the washing machine. Outside, 100% of the landscape's water needs are met by rainwater. When their home was built, extreme care was taken to avoid disturbing or destroying any of the existing native vegetation beyond the footprint of the house. As a result, nothing was spent on landscaping. It already existed. In addition, 98% of the landscape has never needed supplemental irrigation because it was already well established and perfectly adapted to natural rainfall. The 2% of the landscape needing irrigation includes an apple tree planted after the home was built and some potted plants. This irrigation is done entirely with recycled rainwater in the form of gray water from the drains of their washing machine and kitchen sink. Matt and Mary's rainwater oasis in the Sarita Mountains of southwest Arizona is located in a boondoggle development from the 1970s that sold home sites to people sight unseen. No utilities were installed. The few sites and very few sites were ever developed. At sites that were eventually developed, neighbors run generators around the clock for electricity, and nearly all of these people truck in their water, ignoring the rain that falls freely from the sky. Let me pause right here and make a note here. Down in Arizona, for those of you that live in the East here, and you've probably never seen this, but they got whole subdivisions out here in the middle of the desert. Craziest thing you ever saw. You're driving along here, and here's streets. I mean streets, and they're paved, and got it in, and there's lots, and then once in a while you'll find a house in there. And they're probably half-acre lots, maybe an acre, you know, some of them. And there'll be hundreds of them. And it's just a great big subdivision that's never been developed. Nobody ever built any houses there. Hell, they're all over Arizona. Back in the 50s and 60s, there was a land boom. And so people, you know, with money in California and Chicago and New York, they would buy a home site. You buy it for $500, you know. So for $500, some guy in New York City says, well, I own a home site in Tucson, Arizona, or out in Phoenix or someplace, you know. Well, that's what these people did. They bought one of these lots. which you can probably buy today for 50 or 75 bucks out here in the middle of the desert. Now, there's no water out here. I mean, you know, you people are going to starve to death waiting for water. Now, hell, you're probably 50 or 75 miles from the nearest grocery store. It's out here in the boonies someplace. It was a piece of desert land that wasn't worth the powder take to blow it to hell. And they sold it to some guy in New York and thought he had something really great. Well, anyway, there's all these abandoned places. These people went out and took on one of these abandoned lots where there's no water, no sewer, no nothing, out in the middle of the desert. And they're living out there off the rainwater that falls on the area, 14 inches a year. Now, take 14 inches of rainwater a year in Atlanta, Georgia. Why, you people would starve to death on that. Now, these people are living their lives out here in the desert on 14 inches a year. How do they do that? By harvesting the rainwater. Now, if they can do it there, you can do it in Atlanta, Georgia, or anyplace else. Let me tell you a story here. There's a modality here in the United States for delivering electricity, and about half our electricity in this country comes from coal-fired power plants. And they take these big coal trains for you people living in South Korea. You'd have to see this to believe it, because you probably ain't going to believe me. But they take coal trains, and these trains are about 109 cars long. That's what I counted when I saw them going by. And these coal trains are going down the UP tracks in along Highway 30 in Nebraska, one every 15 minutes. And there's three tracks wide headed east, three tracks wide. Every 15 minutes, there comes one of these 109-car coal trains. They call them captive trains. And these coal trains are going to power plants where we generate electricity. Well, there's an example in the National Geographic magazine. They got a power plant there. It's a 30-megawatt power plant. Now, I don't know what megawatt means, but it's a big one. It's a biggie. Because it burns, this is how much coal they use every day, three coal trains. That's 327 coal cars a day. 327 coal cars a day. Three trains. They burn up a train load of coal every 8 hours. Well, that's what was reported. I'm just telling you. Now, that's a lot of coal, kids. There's 100,000 pounds in a coal car. That's 50 tons of coal. 50 tons times 109 is how much? 50 times 109. That's 5,400 tons of coal. 5,500 tons of coal. And they burn three of those times three. That's 16,000 tons of coal a day going through this power plant. But they're delivering electricity to several million people. So I imagine that the unit per person, you know, is probably pretty low. And that's pretty impressive. Now, out in California, they started some projects out there where they would take some houses and they would put these solar panels on the roof to collect some sunlight to generate electricity. And so they got this down to a pretty good science now. They got a lot of houses out there where they're energy independent. That is, you know, you got a house in Sacramento, California, maybe, or Fresno. And they put these solar panels up here on the roof, and the government actually subsidizing some of this construction cost. Now, here's the net result. When you get through at the end of the month, the people that live here, maybe they pay the power company $30. Maybe the power company writes them a check for $30. But, you know, they're about energy independent. There was a guy, I saw him here, I don't know, one of these magazines. He's a wealthy guy from New York. He's a businessman. He retired. And he built himself his dream house up in New Hampshire. And he put in all panels, you know, these electric panels, photovoltaic cells, I think they call them. To collect the sunlight to generate electricity. Now, he spent $50,000. He got this million or $2 million house, but he spent $50,000 putting in the electric system. He's not on the grid at all. Well, now, over in Germany, they picked up on that, and Germany now is trying, this is their goal. They want every house in Germany to be solar powered, and they're working on it. They're building solar panels just fast as they can make them. Now, here in the United States, we generate about 1% of our power in this country from wind power or solar power or, you know, geothermal power or something like that, something other than coal or oil or gas or hydropower or nuclear power. I mean, there's ways to generate power. Coal is number one. It's over 50%. And then about 25% or 20% comes from nuclear power. And then, you know, there's gas-fired power plants, and then there's geothermal power, and there's wind power and so on. And we're only producing about 1% from these alternative sources. And then they tell us it's impossible. You can't do that. The electric needs of America cannot be met without coal. That's poppycock. It's true that it's not going to be. I don't deny that. The political powers and the economic powers that be are going to see to it that it doesn't happen. I don't deny it. But it's not because it can't be. You see, kids, if we want to, we can do it. And if government policy wanted nuclear power, we'd have it. See, 80% of the power generated in France comes from nuclear power. Boys and girls, the French did not invent nuclear power. That was invented here in the United States. Now, the Japanese, they're up around that number, too. They've got about, I don't know, 80% or 60% or something of their power in Japan is being produced by nuclear power. And the reason that they're doing that is because oil costs a lot of money. And if you're living in a country like Japan and you don't have a lot of coal and you don't have a lot of oil and you got to import it, that means you got to pay for it. mean, you got to buy it and pay for it. We Americans don't do that. We buy a lot, but we don't pay for it. Well, then they got to come up with a different solution. So here in America, we've been told, well, we can't have nuclear power. It's too damn dangerous. Well, you'll die by Friday noon at least. Now, the French aren't dying and the Japs aren't dying. And over in Germany, they're making these solar panels as fast as they can so that they don't have to buy oil. We Americans, we're going to buy oil until we bankrupt ourselves. Now, if you can build a house up in New Hampshire, if you can build houses in Fresno, California, and power them with solar power, and do it at the same price. And by the way, these solar power plants, I got one here on my farm. I got a solar power plant here on my farm. And the cost of putting in solar power is just about the same as buying it from the power company. Now, when we buy it from the power company, somebody had to burn some coal. When I generate it from electricity and run it through my battery system over here, I don't have to do that. Now it's now economically comparable too. But now picture this. If you're a coal company like Peabody Coal Company, are you going to be promoting solar power, wind power? Why, no. You're going to run around telling people you can't have nuclear power. Well, it'll kill you by Friday. You can't have solar power. It'll never do the job. It'll do the job in Germany. It does the job in Fresno, California. It does the job in New Hampshire. It does the job here in Ozark County, Missouri. But you see, you people decide that you've got to have this coal-fired power. And then that's what you buy. And the same thing is true with water. See, you people have decided that you have to have 40 inches of rainwater a year. You have to have water from the Colorado River. You have to have water from the Central California Project. Without it, we're going to die by Friday at noon. But hey, kids, there's other people that are living out here in the middle of the desert with no well. Hey, they're living out there in the middle of the desert with no power. And they're not running generators, and they're not hauling water either. Now, if they can do it, we can do it. Once we learn how. Well, I'm about out of time, kids. We're going to have to cut it off right there, and we'll take a look at how to learn how to live without all this water next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Remember, you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. For more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Our time's up. We've got to leave it right there, so we'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.